It is Friday, September 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as a United Nations official calls for a mass relocation program for Europe's migrants, we talk with a human rights researcher on the scene in Hungary.
The refugees are sitting, some of them are sitting on the floor, some of them are on the train, some of them are standing in front of the train.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art's hugely popular China Through the Looking Glass exhibit prepares to close, and a new documentary explores hip-hop fashion. It's all ahead. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, has called on the European Union to admit up to 200,000 refugees to ease the flood of migrants appearing at EU borders looking for shelter. Meanwhile, in the Hungarian city of Bishkek, hundreds of refugees are refusing to get off a train they boarded in Budapest, hoping to travel to Germany, which has announced it will take up to 800,000 applications for refugee status. I'm joined now by Barbora Chernyskova. She's a human rights researcher at Amnesty International, and she's in Bishkek. Barbara, what is the scene like there at the train station?
The refugees are sitting, some of them are sitting on the floor, some of them are on the train, some of them are standing in front of the train, but there is a fence separating them from the rest of the platform, and the platforms are closed. The police is blocking the entrance to the platforms. They were provided with water by the Red Cross, but some of them refused to take it. They refused to disembark the train and go to the reception center here in Bishkek. We spoke to some of the refugees yesterday who were asked to go to Bishkek. We spoke to them at the Keleti station, and they quoted as one of the reasons for refusing to go to the reception center the lack of capacities and the fact that they are overcrowded. It's quite concerning here in terms of the situation of people who have spent the night on the train because of sanitary conditions, but also in terms of their access to food and portable water. And from here, it looks like that the group on the train is quite mixed. There are quite a few men, but then there seems to be also children on the train. And the temperatures are about 28 degrees Celsius, so it's quite hot.
Is it known which countries these particular refugees come from?
The absolute majority is from Syria. The majority of people at the Keleti stations from which the train departed yesterday were Syrians, but there were also Iraqis, Afghanis, and some other nationalities, but these were the main ones.
Is it known yet where these refugees will go?
It's unknown. The government is insisting that they should go to the reception center here. Some of them that we spoke to at Keleti were given instructions that they should go to other reception centers, but these instructions are highly questionable because the capacities of these centers are full to over 100%, in some cases even more. So it's a bit unclear how would they be able to house hundreds of new coming refugees and how the Hungarian authorities aim to ensure that the reception conditions are actually adequate.
Is it known today what the situation is like in Budapest? Because there are a number of refugees there as well.
When I left there last night, there were still thousands of people, many of them sleeping directly at the train station, many of them in the surrounding streets and parks. They were hoping that they would be able to board on trains and leave Budapest, but the Hungarian train company made an announcement yesterday that there would be no trains to Austria and Germany, that all these westbound trains were cancelled. And this seems to be a consistent policy that is still in place today. But it is unclear how long it can continue because new people keep coming to Budapest, and this is clearly not sustainable. There doesn't seem to be a solution put forward by the authorities.
Thank you very much. That is Barbara Chernyskova. She's a human rights researcher at Amnesty International in Hungary. Well, meanwhile, the harrowing image of a drowned 3-year-old Syrian boy washed up on a Turkish beach appears to have galvanized Europe's leaders into doing more to address the refugee crisis. France, Germany, and Italy issued a joint call Thursday for compulsory quotas of refugees for all EU states. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The lifeless boy was dressed in shorts and a T-shirt, face down in the sand. He, his brother and his mother and several others drowned trying to reach Greece Wednesday. The boy, named locally as Aylan Kurdi from Kobani in Syria, is rapidly becoming a symbol of Europe's failure to address the crisis, says Amnesty International. Migrants continue to depart Turkey's shores for Greece, 23,000 last week. Like many of his fellow Syrians, Mohamed Al-Murati has stories of horror.
دمر بيتي. بيتي اللي حلمت عمره أطول حياتي وأمرته بمالي.
Al-Murati says his house that he spent his whole life dreaming of building, that he built with his own money, pain and effort, was destroyed by a barrel bomb that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad threw down from a plane. Everything has been destroyed, the future, the past and the present. Syria has gone, he says. The route to Western Europe runs through the Balkans and Hungary, which is refusing to let refugees through. Clashes erupted Thursday as Hungarian riot police tried to force hundreds of migrants off an Austria-bound train. Journalists were forced to leave the area. Hungary says it is Berlin's problem. Germany, France and Italy jointly called for a compulsory, fair distribution of refugees across Europe. French President François Hollande, in referring to the drowned boy, said it is time to act. Britain, facing criticism for refusing to take a bigger share, said it would fulfil its moral responsibilities. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, how is social media responding, reacting to this very tragic situation?
Well, that photo has kind of galvanized a lot of people on social media, the fellow of Aylan Kurdi. In fact, Kobani is a top trending topic this morning because Aylan was from Kobani and his father's taken him back there to bury him. We're seeing photos of that now. But this has really just galvanized everyone on social media. This is the iconic image of this migrant crisis thus far. So we've seen it shared far and wide. And a lot of people reacting to that, saying this is the time to act. This is the point where we have to really do something. I mean, look at this child that's drowned. We are also seeing hashtag SOS Europe trending. This is an Amnesty International campaign to help refugees as they move across Europe and to try to draw attention to their plight. So that is trending this morning as part of their campaign. Interestingly, on their website for Amnesty Europe, they have in big letters at the top of the page, hashtag SOS Europe. So they're making a big social media push, trying to go where the people are to get the attention on this crisis. Here in the U.S., hashtag Kim Davis is trending. Now, this is a clerk in the U.S. state of Kentucky. She's refusing to issue marriage licenses for same-sex couples. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court back in June ruled that all states will be honoring and performing same-sex marriages. It's federally recognized. But she's refusing to do it, saying it violates her religious beliefs. So it's set off the social media debate, people claiming that she's using her religion as an excuse to promote bigotry. Other people saying that she should stand firm in her convictions. I know Mike Huckabee, who's the former governor of Arkansas, who's running for president as a Republican, said that she, in her arrest, shows that the criminalization of Christianity in the U.S. is happening before our eyes. So he's taking that to quite an extreme on social media and offering his thoughts. And then hashtag Teachers Day. This is an interesting one, I thought. It's trending right now in the U.S. and worldwide, but Teachers Day, September 5th, is only celebrated in India. There are different Teachers Days around the world, and it's interesting how this date that's being celebrated in India, because India is so big and there are a lot of people on social media, it's going up to the top, but then people are also jumping on it and saying, oh, we should. It's Teachers Day here in the U.S., so people are kind of making it their own holiday as well. So it speaks to how things like this kind of spread on social media, especially now that here in the U.S. everyone's going back to school either this week or next week. So the timing works out well. But the quote that a lot of people are sharing on social media is from Prime Minister Modi in India. He said, the mother gives birth, but the teacher gives life to the child. So a lot of people saying that's a nice quote for the start of the new school year.
Yeah, it is very nice. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. Have you ever wondered how many trees there are in the world? A new study led by Yale University has an answer. More than 3 trillion. The study also estimates that the number of Earth's trees has dropped by about 46% since the beginning of human civilization. To make their findings, the researchers used a combination of tools such as satellite imagery, forest inventories, and supercomputers. These technologies allowed them to chart the more than 3 trillion trees throughout the world, right down to the square kilometer level. 2 years ago, using only estimates and satellite imagery, it was thought that there were just 400 billion trees worldwide. Among the benefits provided by trees include their ability to store enormous amounts of carbon and that they are vital for the cycling of the Earth's nutrients, water, and air. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about hip-hop fashion. Monday, the Labor Day holiday here in the United States, will be the final day for a highly successful exhibit at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Costume Institute's exhibit is called China Through the Looking Glass and is one of the most popular shows ever displayed at the renowned museum. I'm joined on the line by Maxwell K. Hearn. He is the Douglas Dillon Chairman of Asian Art at the Met. Mr. Hearn, what is the scale of this exhibit's success?
The exhibit is actually one of the largest, if not the largest, museum exhibitions ever mounted by the museum because it occupies something like 30,000 square feet. It's taken over virtually all of the Chinese galleries in the museum for the permanent collection, as well as the permanent galleries for the Costume Institute, and even one small space in the Egyptian wing, so that we are spread out across 3 floors. And so it's really a vast undertaking. So just from the point of view of scale alone, it is a very grand undertaking.
Yes, I had the privilege of visiting just last weekend, and I don't recall I've ever been to a Met exhibit that was on 3 floors like that before.
We wanted to tie the show together. The concept behind the show is to present the inspiration that China has provided to Western designers across several centuries, beginning with chinoiserie in the 17th and 18th century, and coming right down to the present. And we felt it would be very meaningful to place these costumes within the Chinese galleries to juxtapose works of art from the Chinese collections with these Western fashions to really make the point that various ways of in which Western designers have taken, drawn inspiration from Chinese traditional art.
And it was very striking seeing not only the costumes, but the use of film and music. It really combined a number of media. It was really quite striking.
The premise of the exhibition, which was curated by Andrew Bolton from the Costume Institute, but which we were very happy to collaborate with him and bring the expertise of our Chinese specialists to bear on the show, was that China has been a source of inspiration, starting with export fabrics and blue and white ceramics, and then subsequently, as museum collections developed in the West, these collections became a source of inspiration. And finally, in the 30s and later, cinema was a very important source of giving people an impression about what Chinese life or Chinese fashion was all about. So it became a very significant part of the exhibition to choose films starting in the 1930s that portrayed China either by Western filmmakers or subsequently by Chinese filmmakers themselves.
And a prominent film in the exhibit is some of the sound and some of the film from The Last Emperor.
Yes, so the exhibition begins with a series of galleries that present 3 ages of Chinese culture. The Imperial Age, which is typified by the dragon robe of the Qing Dynasty emperors, the Republican era, which is typified by the qipao, which is a very slender, close-fitting dress for women, and finally the Maoist era, where the Mao suit became the one fashion that unified all of China, and which in turn had its impact on Western designers. So those three ages are really set forth in the opening sections of the exhibition.
And why do you think this exhibit has been so successful? It was extended for 3 weeks.
I think that China is a subject that people are fascinated by. We recognize that China has become politically and economically a major force on the world stage today, but that there's still a need for us to understand its culture. And the fact that there is this long tradition of imagining China in the West, sometimes it's more fantasy than reality, makes it clear that the West is still struggling to come to a deeper appreciation and understanding of what Chinese culture and what Chinese civilization is all about. But the very fact that China is such a prominent part of the show, I think, has made it enormously popular, not to mention the fact that the dresses themselves are so sumptuous and beautiful. It's clear that people find that very easy to relate to.
Yes, I think they do. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hearn.
You're most welcome. It's so nice to talk with you.
And that's Maxwell K. Hearn. He's Douglas Dillon Chairman of Asian Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Hip-hop fashion is now a part of mainstream culture, but there was a time when hip-hop was just breaking into its own identity, not only musically, but also in fashion. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about a new documentary that looks at that time. It's called Fresh Dressed.
It documents the evolution of what we consider to be hip-hop fashion, hip-hop dress, as a form of individual creative expression to what is now, quite honestly, close to a $1 billion industry.
And some of this emerged in New York, particularly when you had street gangs that were, instead of fighting one another, they were doing raps, and they would spray paint their clothes and do this kind of stuff in wild kind of graffiti designs in order to distinguish themselves from other people.
Right. It was part of the B-boy culture. And the documentary really goes into not only the different gangs, but so interesting, it goes into how the different boroughs in New York City expressed themselves and how they dressed. And there are a number of people who are interviewed who said, you know, sometimes you could go to the Apollo and you look at one guy and go, oh, he's from the Bronx, or he's from Brooklyn, or he's from Harlem. Each borough had its own way or its own form of expression. And then eventually all that came together as hip hop, the music, started to become more popular. And then everyone from around the country started to pick up on those cues. And, you know, you had girls like me in Detroit wearing big bangle earrings because Salt and Pepper, my favorite hip hop group, was wearing them at the time.
And the expression fresh dressed refers to being you know, fresh out of the box.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm clean.
I'm clean and I'm fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And I have new Adidas shoes that, you know, they had the big starched laces and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this really has influenced a lot of top designers, because you had people like Givenchy and Yves Saint Laurent, everybody picking up on this trend and incorporating it into their designs for high fashion houses.
Yeah, and this is nothing new. I think all subcultures will eventually influence mainstream culture. I mean, we saw it, of course, with hip-hop, and we're now almost 40 years into that. But, you know, even when we talked about grunge, remember back in the early 90s, grunge was influencing what Marc Jacobs and a lot of the bigger designers were doing. So this is just a natural progression. But I think fresh dressed is really fun, because I don't know that too many people realize where it all began and what it actually looked like. As those who were in the culture started to make more money and become more affluent, then the dress started to change. So yes, yeah, so you had Diddy and Russell Simmons coming out with suits and things that normally weren't associated with the culture, but now are.
All right, the film is called Fresh Dressed. And if you have any comments, please send us a tweet. Shauna, you can tweet her directly. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. Be sure to listen for her in the Soul Lounge. You can find that at our website, voanews.com.
Fresh dressed like a million bucks. Threw on the ballet shoes and the fly green socks. Stepped out the house, stopped short. Oh, no, I went back in. I forgot the, then I dally, ran through a alley, bumped into my old girl, Sally, from the valley. This is a girl plays hard to get, so I said, what's wrong, cause she looked upset, she said.
That is music from the documentary Fresh Dressed. And that's our show. Please look at our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on three more leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked, Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabab. The men are Yasin Kilwe, Abdikader Mohammed Abdikader, also known as Ikrimah, and Jafar, also known as Ammar. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, has control of large areas of southern and central Somalia and is responsible for the death of thousands of Somali citizens, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has engaged in a campaign of violence, including bombings and suicide attacks, which has killed thousands. In July 2010, it planned and executed a bomb attack in Kampala, Uganda, that killed more than 70 people, including an American citizen. Yasin Kilwe is Al-Shabaab's leader in the Puntland region of Somalia. He pledged his allegiance to Al-Qaeda in February 2012. Abdikader, 34 years old, was born in Kenya of Somali parents. He has coordinated recruitment of Kenyan youth into Al-Shabaab and commanded a force of Kenyan fighters operating in Somalia. He reportedly has medium-length hair, a thick mustache, and is missing three fingers on his left hand. Jafar has served as Abdikader's deputy and reportedly is missing one eye. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy. Submit a tip through the RFJ website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. The United States guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com.